Hello,
Hello.
it's the Watson Weekend. We're your host, Nick. New face, new face, not a
I
new
mean, am
name.
I was gonna say, am I a new? I mean, I'd love a new face, but this is not a new face, and you are not a
I'm
new
Jess
face
Willis-Heskey.
either. Well, it's great to be back. We are bringing you your dose of the weekly e-com circus. No, not much better with Rick Watson out. They did bring me back. I don't know, Jess, what do you think?
I've missed you, Nick. It's always a good time when you're sitting in the chair as a stand-in. And we've got some good things up our sleeve today because when the cat's away, the mice will play. So it's summer. We're a little punchy. We're going to have some fun today.
We are definitely going to put the F back in fun today. I've been practicing waiting for Rick to go on vacation, so I am super happy to be back to join you and re walk down memory lane.
That's right. That's right. It could be fun for the F in fun or the F in TGIF, right? I
I
mean,
mean, either.
what more could we do? Well, we have a wonderful show, and it is thanks to our sponsor, Crystal. They are the smarter way to EDI. See why brands like NeuroGum and Andy Swim love it at crstl.ai. So we're so happy to have them. Nick, what's the summer like in the city right now? How are things
Well,
going,
let's before we even get there, let's talk about like where I am, right? I mean, like, when I've been here in the past, I'm in another, we have this office, the worldwide headquarters of RMW,
Yes, it's
and
where all the
I'm not in
magic
this chair.
happens.
So, I mean, but I will say that today was a beautiful day. So the city has been brutal, similarly to how we find the world of retail these days and commerce. But we're here. How about you? Are you Carolina home, Carolina Beach? Like, how are you? How's
Yeah, I'm
summer?
Carolina home right now, and kids are camping or sleeping, depending on if you're 15 or 10.
Nice.
And I'm just trying to survive the heat wave, just like everybody else. So threw on my Miami Vice jacket, and I'm gonna call it
Well, let's crock it and tubs it right on in
There we
to
go.
the right to the headline hangover.
That's right. Little new game we're gonna play. Nick, I'm gonna kind of walk through this story, and then I'm gonna have you guess
Okay.
what the text is gonna be, okay?
Okay, I'm
So,
ready.
after careful consideration and extensive discussions with our members, we have made the difficult decision to what?
After careful consideration, gosh, they made the difficult decision to raise prices.
Oh, it's such a good guess. It is cancel NRF Nexus 2025. So let me set the scene for you here. And I don't know if you've been to this conference
I mean,
before,
I am
but last
so
year,
disappointed
I know you're like single tier,
right
right? So last year, this conference was the thing not to be. Executives said, can't miss it, save my calendar every year. The think tank roundtables are really like got all the juices flowing. And the networking is just top notch. It's elite. Like, I bring my whole team. So, it was the kind of event that was supposed to make you smarter just for attending. But this year, it's ghosted. Nowhere. There's no, just candid, nothing happening. And so, I guess my question for you, when, they're going to pull the plug with really no press release or fanfare, is this just the crowd stopped curating? The open bar just couldn't stay open due to budget cuts? Or did the retail brain trust just realize, like, hey, we can do this from Zoom in our sweatpants? What do you think went down?
Are you giving me a D, all of the above?
I can.
I think it, in all seriousness, is probably more the budget cuts and the moment in time. And I think that conferences are great. We talk about it all the time
They're
about,
necessary.
right, the ne well, it's it they're necessary for doing business, for building relationships, whether it's from vendor to client or people to people. it's wonderful. However, it isn't free at all. Yeah. And ultimately, not a ton of business gets done at a conference. And so with what's happening, and it's not necessarily a marquee conference.
Yeah.
Not surprised. Although surprised that the NRF, who is very much brand first, didn't have a better delivery of the message.
It's a little sweep under the rug.
Right? So, it was like, wait, what?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There ain't no party like an NRF party, because there literally is no NRF party.
Well, you know, according to the NRF, holiday sales will comp 10%, so we'll be fine.
Here we go. Right. All right. You got one for me?
Yes, I have one for you. So, all right. OpenAI and Shopify reportedly working on what?
Joint commerce venture?
A ChatGPT checkout integration.
Yes, I was close, right? Do I get like some kind of bonus point?
So the world of RMW does events, and by the way, does events right.
Yeah.
And around a conference, the lead, there was an event called Tariff Feud, and for those that didn't get a chance to see any of it, you gotta find a picture of the Rick Watson with the wig and the blazer.
And there was blazer. Not just
there were a lot
blazer,
of questions.
There were lots of sequins.
Well, I was the judge and was, you know, there were a few controversial ones. In this case, as the judge, I will give you credit for that.
Okay,
what,
thank you.
What do you think of this? I mean, this is big.
Yeah, it is big. I mean, I think we know that OpenAI, while like in all their glory, and they need to continue to find ways to monetize. And we have been waiting for, like, Perplexity is like working on closing the loop. It was probably just a matter of time right before OpenAI went there. And who to do that better with than Shopify, who's powering so much of the world's commerce, especially with SMBs that likely aren't going to have the wherewithal to go out and do integrations like this solo. So I think it's pretty smart. I have found the other side of the LinkedIn naysayers who are like, no, this is never going to work. And it wasn't necessarily about the Shopify ChatGPT, but just these OpenAI LLMs trying to do commerce in general, because Meta has failed. Other kind of sites that have not oriented from commerce have not necessarily been able to crack it. But I don't know that it's going to be the same kind of thing in this situation. I mean, like, TikTok's been able to figure out commerce. I'm not saying like the case is closed on this one and it's a failed experiment yet.
Oh, I am. I mean, there could be a whole show on this. I'm a huge bull on this. You know, I believe that we're moving into this. You know, we did research, and we had a point around NRF. We did an event as well. And one thing that Rick said that I thought was really salient was like, your next channel isn't even born yet. And so
that's right.
I feel like this is big. It's going to be commerce everywhere, but you have to have a unified basket. I always thought Facebook would be that. And the fact they abandoned commerce was crazy to me, but this is going to be big. I also think what's interesting is they're going to charge a VIG. It's going to be 2%. And some of the others you mentioned, Perplexity, were not going to be doing that. And so I think it will reset things, but we have two others to get through and a great show on tap. So I don't want to take away from it, but this is big. Anyone that's not paying attention and jumping into this is crazy. Naysayers, go away. Go away. It's happening.
Park your comments.
Exactly.
All right. Okay. So I got another one for you. Albertsons CEO says cottage cheese sales are up, and it's partly due to what?
I mean, I want to say it like something tariff related to tariffs.
Oh, you know what? It's the TikTok that does not stop, Nick.
What?
And yes, it is. Cottage cheese is having its main character moment, and it is due to all the world of creators who are now whipping up their cottage cheese pancakes, cottage cheese ice cream, cottage cheese chips. I mean, this is the protein that just doesn't want to stop, Nick. It is the 80s diet food. If you remember, I mean, I'm old enough that I was like hitting up Shoney's and Golden Corral, and that was a hot Sunday. And that was kind of the side piece on the buffet that just was trash that no one actually touched. But no, it's back, and it's back in a big way. The cottage cheese.
I love cottage
cheese. Yeah, I mean, well, who doesn't? It's so dreamy. Curds are cool, man. So U.S. cottage cheese sales were at $1.2 billion. They are now at $1.75 billion. It's 18% up year over year. Had like Crazy. It's 52-week high. And so, yeah, like the grocery store, they can't just keep it on the shelves. Like they're having some supply chain issues. So, you know, it just goes to show you anything can look good with mood lighting and a wooden spoon.
I mean, super bummed because now and like, 4 weeks, my cottage cheese is going to be like 40% more expensive to both slow down demand as well as the, you know, like this is the price, the repricing land grab.
Yeah. Yeah. But exactly. Yeah. We just kind of need someone uncool to eat it.
Right. Exactly. Well, it's like the TikTok effect. And you look at the, you know, everyone talks about like lightning in a bottle of virality and how, you know, how you do it well. And I think that so many people have ideas. So few people on this level execute them well. Doesn't mean you should stop trying, but you know, there's two things that you've said related. One on TikTok, you know, figured out commerce. I'd say it almost like a little bit differently, which like TikTok has figured out how to like catalytically move commerce. I find it's really impacting Amazon. Amazon is a huge beneficiary of all these people sort of like going from TikTok there. And two, it's like you have to find alternative means of like selling your brand and building credibility. And so if you can eat cottage cheese and really reset the bar and become cool, it's demonstrative of like what everybody should at least be striving for and achieving if they're lucky, maybe some modicum of that success. But wow, I'm 0 for 2, Jess. Like, what the heck?
You're 0 for 2, and I kind of got half a point. So I think we're not winning.
I'll go to my number four. I mean, you've already won, so it's sort of like the home field. But we're playing, you know, for the audience.
That's right.
All right, coming to us from Digiday. Mm-hmm. So overheard at Digiday's CTV ad strategy event. Streaming is reaching what percentage of all upfront dollars?
Ooh, streaming is reaching what percent of all? I'm going to go 43.
Survey says it is now reaching 50%.
Wow. Wow.
And I think it is also emblematic of people's testing new channels.
Yeah.
Wanting real data, which I think streaming adds
100%
audience targeting and efficiency. I think that what we're now seeing in the world of media spend is this not dissimilar to experiences, right? We sort of began our journeys in commerce with like one to all. It's like, this is who we are. This is our site. This is our email. And this is our ad strategy. We're just going to throw a bunch of stuff on Facebook or Google or see what happens.
And spray and pray.
Now, exactly. Now we are the antithetical spray and pray. We are super specific. We are very, very much craving data, using data and making decisions. And people are looking for alternatives to the traditional means, and not that CTV is like super progressive, but it's definitely something that had barriers to entry, challenges, and it has really come a long way in measurement and productivity. And so, I mean, I was like surprised, not surprised, but
yeah, I guess if I was in Price is Right, maybe I had a shot at coming closest to the to the price without going over. So, I mean, Nick, I do have to ask a very serious question.
Okay.
When is the last time you clicked on a QR code on an ad on your TV?
Never.
Okay. Yeah. I was just curious. Like, it, you know, that's one of the elements of these connected TV ads. Amazon does it a ton, right? Like, they throw, if you're watching Prime, they'll throw some kind of QR code up. I haven't gone there yet. I'm curious if people do.
Who was it during the Super Bowl a couple of years ago? I think 2 years ago, just like their ad was just a QR code.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
But I think that the direct correlation in a QR code, the trackability and you know, hopefully bringing someone to exactly where everyone's going to be is important. But at the same time, I look at all these different means of distributing content, sort of like the bus shell ad.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, you don't know where or how many times you're going to engage, but the more frequency you have, the more separation you have and the more top of mind you become. And I think it's a longer strategy. And I think that knowing who you're serving and having an ICP, like, right, you every brand has to have a, you know, like a muse, right? It's like Mildred or it's like
Franny. At Shutterfly, ours was, we had Bargain Betty was, well, that was Snapfish.
I mean, stop right there.
Yeah.
Whenever your customer has the bargain in her name, it's like,
winner, winner, chicken dinner. Okay. So, all right. Well, look, we, hope you enjoy this little game. We're going to keep kicking it around and changing up the format here. But we cannot hold back any longer from our very distinguished guest, Dilip Keshu. He had a chance to speak with Rick, and we're really excited to bring this interview to you. Dilip is an award-winning CEO who founded Born Group. It's an agency that was acquired by Tech Mahindra in November of 2019. And at the time of the acquisition, Born was one of the largest independently held agencies in the world. He's on the board of Pininfarina, listed in Italy, Sophronic, a design house that focuses on animation and gaming, two things that are very, very hot right now, speaking of the talk. He is currently a board member of a SaaS startup called Reclaims, focused on asset-based financing for healthcare providers, Prohance, a workforce efficiency platform, and Sensible, a Gen AI brand benchmarking agency. And if I butchered any of those, I sincerely apologize. But we can't delay it any longer. We're going to roll this interview. Nick, any final thoughts?
No, just that Born was big. I mean, you know, a couple of people that worked there, they did incredible work in e-commerce for a really long time. They still do, but they were a trailblazer. So I'm super excited to hear Rick, a great interviewer, ask the questions and most importantly, hear the answers. I think it should be super insightful.
Great. Well, we're going to roll it. Have a great Friday, you guys.
So glad to be here on the Watson Weekend. Welcome, everyone. Where creative minds meet cold margins. Today, we're joined by Dilip Keshu, so agency founder and architect. How do you describe yourself? Technologist, inventor, philosopher of commerce. And I think at a high level, we're wanting to unpack today what happens after everything's been built, everyone has been sold to, and you're not sure what to create next. Because the roadmaps seem like they're already there. Like, how do we evolve? Welcome, Dilip, to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thanks, Rick.
Awesome. I mean, I suppose my first question should be to ask, how'd you get from being a product manager at a CAD design firm to now kind of being this global commerce superstar? I think most of our audience would recognize you as the founder and CEO of Born Group, which was sold to Tech Mahindra and advisor to so many startups across the ecosystem. What drives you? And I guess, how did you get introduced to commerce and what started that journey?
So for a long time, I've been an observer of changes. You know, I call them market discontinuities. Back when I was a younger man, I saw the custom software give way to package software in the field of ERP, enterprise resource planning. I then saw the offshoring of jobs to other locations, and I leveraged the ITO, BPO boom. And then in 2011, I'm a father of three kids. I noticed my kids spending a lot of time on their phone. And I always wondered, how does a marketing officer get a message across on a phone to a young kid if they don't understand iOS or any operating system that is out there? And I felt there was another discontinuity coming with the pervasion of the internet and homes and at work, and collusion of technology and marketing. And I saw the birth of, and data, I saw the birth of a new title. It was the chief digital officer. Mm-hmm. And initially I was thinking there's the CIO, there's the chief data officer, and there's the CMO. And I started to see the first signs of chief digital officer showing up. Mm-hmm. And so I felt that I could put my mind to work and come up with a formula that solved at least a few problems, not all. That was really...
Yeah.
How I started Born, combining a little bit of art, which was content creation and content expression, which is what agencies do, along with tech, which is science. And I combined, I think, art and science. And I think our logo was, we set up this at the intersection of art and science. That was our first tagline when we started. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a magic formula. It worked for at least 10 years. And then many people started to do the same thing. So, it caught on. But that's really,
right.
It's curiosity that put me so far away from my college degree, which is aerospace.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's interesting because you mentioned that a lot of people caught on, which seemed to indicate that, markets become saturated because everyone seems the same opportunity. And I think you've kind of posited ultimately that, what do companies like when they feel like they're in this kind of market to do, like, is it possible to stand out? Or is it, you mentioned that only habit creates demand in a market where there are too many people doing the same thing. And how do you get behind that?
I think there are two stages, there are three stages of growth. The first is what I call the Keynesian model, where demand creates supply. There was a need to marry art and science, and I think Born was right at that focal point. So the market lifted us and took us to the size we've grown to. But I think when the market starts to saturate, think about it, Rick, what brand doesn't have a website today or an app? I mean, it's just totally saturated. There's so many commerce players, and they're good copycats, right? So many people have come into the field. But I truly believe that a Keynesian model where demand creates supply can change at an inflection point. And that is when these agencies that are in a saturated market start to think, I don't look different. I'm not unique. I need to be differentiated. I'm not unique, but I want to be differentiated. So they start to innovate. It's probably evolutionary innovation, not revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And those little things they do start to, when they supply to the market, it actually creates more demand. So that's called Say's Law, which where supply creates its own demand. So I like to think of these dynamics as how a market stays evergreen. And you've seen the proof of this in CRM with Salesforce and ERP with SAP. Still, people are still buying lots of that stuff. And it's because their innovation always coming down the pike.
Right.
And today with AI and AR, VR, and content that's immersive and data that's one-to-one personalized, not cohort-based marketing, I think there's ample opportunity for a refresh. And make the market young again. So that's the way I think about it. But
I think there are a few different signs of the equation because, clearly you spent a lot of time inside of agencies and system integrators, and there wasn't anyone fulfilling this task to help bring package software to life, or custom software for that for that matter. And then it hit, you mentioned the inflection point, which is everyone seems to be doing the same thing. No one can stand out. What was that moment in the e-commerce universe for you? Like when you stood up and you were like, we have a problem here, and I think the industry needs to move beyond just enabling between art and science. We need another plane to get to the next place.
For me, I think it was as I studied customers. Initially, you know, you didn't need to study customer demand because it was just so overwhelmingly big. There was food for everyone. Mm-hmm. But when the market gets tough, you think a lot, you reflect a lot on how do I keep my agency at the top and what should I be doing? And so you actually, it's a weird thing to say, but it's at that time that you focus on your customers more. Mm-hmm. And one of my beliefs is that for the last 40 years or so, marketing has been targeted through segmentation and cohorts. But the truth is no two millennials are the same, no two baby boomers are the same. We are completely different. And data science and predictive science hasn't reached a maturation where we can do one-to-one personalization. So if I go to a site and I come back a second time, the site can't completely morph itself to just to accommodate me. But that's happening with AI. You know, I think cohort marketing is being replaced with at least descriptive science. You know, I use these terms carefully because I think there's too much of these common words used. So in AI, there are three parts to it. There's generative, which is OpenAI, Gemini, and others. But there's also descriptive, where you use AI with agents to tell you what's happening to your brand. Are you doing well? If you benchmark your brand with competition, are you up, below? How are you moving? And the third is, of course, predictive. So it's generative, it's descriptive, and it's predictive. Good. I don't think anyone's got the predictive piece down and working, because AI engines still hallucinate. Until that's ironed out, predictive math is not going to work. But there's so many avenues to think about how a customer's behavior is changing. Uh-huh. So to answer your question, I came up with this term called unique buying proposition. And the first time I started to promote it, I was kind of laughed out of the room. But I was trying to tell people that everyone's a publisher today, and they are going to social media and telling you what they feel, what they want, what they plan to do. So you could build a propensity model where you could stop focusing on your unique selling proposition, which is the USP, but morph it to the unique buying proposition to be more relatable. And to me, that was a big turning point in how I thought about changing our offerings to be more personalized.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, don't tell the millions of personalization companies that are already promising one-to-one personalization for the past 5-10 years. So what part of what you're telling me is that's not being delivered? But I definitely agree with your idea that everyone is a publisher. That's something we see with a lot of our clients at RMW, is say that every brand needs to think of themselves as a media company. And there's a simple formula: media plus data is commerce. And it seems like your thesis is really along similar lines, in that if you're not putting yourself out there, not relating to your audience and getting feedback around what you should be doing, where your products need to head, then you've already started dying.
I think so. And you're right about personalization engines. They've always existed, but they sit on top of models that are based on segmentation and cohorts. And I think because of compute power and AI engines today and the advances in machine learning, you know, things have just changed a little bit. Back in 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we didn't have such compute power and AI engines to do reasoning, for example, at scale. You know, if you have 5 options on a car out of 20, a 5C20 is about 15,000. Now, a human being can possibly think of maybe 5,000 variants or maybe 1,000 variants, but 15,000 is really a machine's job. It's just at a scale that's too big. It's the same with healthcare. You know, there are at least 5,000 side effects, but a a pill can't be made so big with all the additives to cater to all 5,000 side effects. They only cater to maybe five or six. So, you know, I really think technology has caught up for us to do the second version of personalization, which will be far more accurate. The last comment I'll make on this personalization is perhaps that we never get it right because human beings are not the same. I know I won't take names here, but I've gone to a couple of sites where they've seen me behave in a certain way. And when I come back, the ads are very contextual, but I've changed. I don't want to see those ads anymore. And so people also change.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I see a lot of times in the personalization space with brands in particular is that they don't have enough data, messages, products to personalize for personalization to be meaningful. And so to me, you're kind of hinting at where your thought process is if you're going to go from a SKU range of 50 to 100 to 15,000, you need to move the AI up a level into the manufacturing and design, which means that if a human is involved in the meticulous crafting of every single SKU, you're never going to get to the personalization that your diverse audience is really going to appreciate.
I truly believe that, you know, there's a new market, I call it again discontinuity, but in the classic case, a brand put out its products, it was accepted or not accepted. But today people need choice. And so you'll see that half the audiences that start a search started on a marketplace. And so I've started to research this thing called C2M, which is contract to manufacture to marketplace. And that's where your supply chain is in cahoots with you to customize a product for that personalization, within limits, of course.
It seems to me that this is quite similar. And in fact, your acronym is backwards. So there's M to C. I've seen manufacturing to consumer with like a Shein's model, or which is obviously has some unique vagaries of, you know, the Chinese workforce experience and what they're able to do launching thousands or tens of thousands of SKUs per week. Is that model relevant across the board beyond fashion trends?
I think as long in B2B, I'm not so sure, but for B2C, as long as there's a consumer and the consumer is changing with each generation, it's going to be an evergreen market. Now, of course, there are limits to how much you can personalize for people, especially in streaming media. You know, if you go to any popular asset, they have a profile and then they track what you're watching, and what you watch yesterday may not be what you watch tomorrow. So it's a science that's developing. I think mass customization is one solution, and that's what the market's at now. And hyper-personalization is a level above that. It's taking mass customization to make it relevant to you and me, and that's not so easy.
Yeah, I mean, let's look a little bit into where the industry is already taking some of the AI tools that are out there, which is generating websites. It's almost like we're still in this sort of motorized horse version of AI, call it. If you were going to use kind of cars and planes as the eventual result, we haven't envisioned what it's going to be. And so you see companies like Shopify and others release these MCP servers, and they're just trying to speed up what you're already doing, like a prompt to generate the front end of a website, which is, again, static, more or less. And it doesn't seem to hit the level that you're thinking about as what the next level of commerce could be.
I think platforms like Shopify, which are absolutely stunning, you know, they've eaten the world, like I wrote in my article, one bite at a time. They need to do it at scale because they handle millions of merchants. But, you know, it's the boutique agency that needs to think about how to take that platform, which is mass customized today, to be hyper-personalized. And so that last mile is not I don't think platform players will ever get that right because of the vagaries of consumers and different markets. But I think that's the opportunity for agencies to do that. And I honestly don't see too many people talking about it today, which is a pity because everywhere, I'm a bit of a recluse. People won't laugh at me. I'm very honored to do this show, but you won't see me too much in media. But back in the day, I would not go to these events, and I broke with my tradition for the first time this year, and I went to Shop Talk, and I was walking around and meeting people, and a large majority of the agency owners said, "We're starting a Shopify practice." It's like, okay,
right?
How does that make you any different from the others who've been there for 5 to 10 years, right?
Yeah.
And so I would use the analogy, and I'm not one to inspire anyone, but at least my kids, I try to say that the analogy that one has to think about is when Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay conquered the Everest, The world called it an expedition. They called it a conquest. It made its way to Wikipedia. But today, if you tell someone I'm going to the base camp of Everest, it's a form of mild tourism. It's not right. A conquest. It's so
right.
Say that you're going to the base camp of the mountain. That's interesting, but you know, there's a lot more that comes after that. So I'm trying to just encourage people with my peaks and posts to think just that little level above.
So in the era where the brands are being told that the platform is going to do everything for them, we'll generate, you know, type in a few prompts, I can create the next watch brand. You're all saying that there are two problems here. Number one is, why are you creating another watch brand at all? Does the world need another watch brand? And you're also saying to the agency owners, like, add value in other ways. Because maybe the game has moved to the agency world too.
I think it's totally moved. And so an AI-infused agency that is thinking out of the box, I think will do well. And a lot of people are trying. I'm not going to say that no one is trying. I've met so many agencies that have got some really cool tools. They're just not at the level of industrial scale today because of the nature of AI evolving. But anything that's wrote and that can be done by AI will be done by AI, from code generation to activities like posting on social media, like 5 posts on LinkedIn, 5 posts on Facebook. That part is going to really peter out and be replaced by AI. But it's going to be interesting to see what the next 5 years brings, you know.
I mean, one thing that AI doesn't necessarily, it could do a lot of things wrote for you, but AI hasn't proven yet it can move culture, which, you know, it definitely feels like if you're going to create a phenomenon like scaling a peak or creating the brand that people were going to care about for the next generation, you need to do something significantly out of the ordinary. That is, why do you think we're lacking that kind of inspiration now? Or you just find it, but you can't. Maybe you're saying it's there, but you can't find it because there's so much noise to sift through, or you're indicating that it's not there at all.
I think of the analogy with human beings, and let's say there's on the one side the human beings and one side AI. Human beings, the very base level, when you're born, you're talented. Someone, your parents give you some DNA that makes you have a talent or talents. You then apply that talent to a capacity and you become skilled. And I would say 80 to 90% of the market hires you because of your skill. So I know SAP, I know Shopify, I know BigCommerce, I know VTEX, whatever.
Enough.
It's a skill-based hire. And then when you apply skill with behavior, I use the term competence. So you can have two skilled CEOs, but one is more competent because their behavior is more amenable to employee welfare. And then the third is habit. If you're competent, which is skill plus behavior, and you repeatedly do something in a predictable fashion, you can set a culture in a firm. In wherever you go to that firm, whoever you talk to, you can assume that there's going to be a professional outcome. If you look at AI now on this side, I think the talent piece, it's already there. Generative AI has, you know, it's already created that base. Now it's training on skill. The acquired capacity is being done right now. It just lacks the behavioral aspect of how do you use AI? What are the ethics associated to it? What's good? What's bad? That's still being debated. So I don't think we have the competence layer and we don't have the habit layer. So I think we are still at the skills level. And that's the way I tell people that this is going to get better and better. And one day the AI machines will be competent because they will emulate behavior that a company appreciates. But we are very far away from that. So,
yeah, no, I think that's probably right. There's also this message of like, call it creative risk. And I think you're hinting at it, and maybe not in the creativity point of view, but you know, the idea, if you kind of go back to, you know, the great films of the last 100 years, you have to do something that's a little bit out of the norm, that has a distinctive style, that's not just sort of copying everything else. And I think a lot of brands still aren't doing that. And that's that human inspiration, which will either brainstorm with the AI to then create the appropriate risk. But at some point, the human still needs to make the judgment. It's like, this is good enough or this is not good enough. It's not, at least anytime soon, going to be fully autonomous brand building, right?
Yeah, I think it's like a robo taxi, right? It can take you from point A to B, provided it has a map. But if you don't have the map, it's not going to pathfind for you. A human being has an inbuilt pathfinding capability and it can never be replaced, I believe. So the analogy is simply that AI is a lever that people use to do things faster and better. It's like a cycle or a motorcycle, but it's never going to be anywhere close to what a human's capable of, I think. And but who knows, you know?
Yeah. You've been through a lot of, and I've observed as well, kind of this system integrator / agency roll-up play. And it seems to me there are different levels in a firm's existence that suddenly the multiples get bigger. And so as a result, the natural tendency is to get above that multiple so that you can then get a higher value for your agency. I've seen the number is 5 million or 10 million or 25 million. And now you're suddenly worth some multiple of revenue versus just, you know, your trailing EBITDA or something like this. Is that a... And perhaps this, you know, maybe you're exactly the wrong person to ask, or maybe exactly the right person to ask. Is this tendency to combine agencies? Is it? Can you create a value judgment on it, or is it not worth your time? It's just sort of the nature of things.
I think largely I wouldn't say it's the nature of things, but it's the mechanics of things. So if you look at large SIs, almost all of them are public. The public markets, especially retail traders, never read a balance sheet. They read the P&L. It's earnings per share. So why invest in innovation when you're going to be punished for it because your EBITDA will come down, at least in the early stages? So the large companies, you know, they just accumulate their wealth on the balance sheet, and then they quietly buy agencies to buy the innovation and bring it in-house. And so it's a balance sheet game versus a P&L game. And that's because the stock markets reward people with the wrong metrics, which is only earnings per share. I'm generalizing a bit here, but, you know, I'm just talking. So I think it's too difficult and macro a problem for people to solve. When I was building Born, I never saw the big SIs in the space, but then I started to see some of them show up, because they had bought very good agencies. And these are the likes of Deloitte and Accenture, you know, phenomenal companies that we didn't compete with. And then they were in the room And that's when I decided that I needed a better balance sheet, a bigger balance sheet. We didn't stay in the room. And that's why I sold. But everyone has a different motivation. I think the idea of just accumulating assets, creative assets, like the holding companies, that market's going to come under a lot of stress. I think the four or five large holding companies that buy creative agencies and put them, and they keep them like the tribal knowledge, you know, art is a métier, as they say. So that's not scalable. Art can never be a scale game. And just by buying more and more of these little villages of tribal art, I don't know how that makes any sense, but maybe it does, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating, mate, because it's like, as soon as you try to scale art, it doesn't become art because it becomes popular.
Exactly.
And that sense, and it's available to everyone, which means it needs to become templated. And now we're just painting by numbers rather than taking risks.
I couldn't agree more. Exactly. that's the market today. So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we've undergone this transition between, you know, if you look at the last 20, 30 years of commerce, it was, what is this digital thing? How do we take advantage of it? Do we need a website? Why do we need a website? Oh, I'm worried that this is going to cannibalize my store, right? And it's like, oh, now we've figured it out. The consumer goes on a journey. It feels like we're back in the place where everything needs to be connected, one of your early thesis for Born was this sort of experience-led thesis for consumers, meaning that to me, the highest form of that is your brands, how they communicate to customers need to reflect how a consumer lives their life and wants to live their life, either aspirationally or, you know, we're always, you know, seeking pleasure, avoid pain. That's, you know, the kind of the two modes. One's a little bit stronger than the other, but not terribly much stronger. Somewhat it depends on who you are. But do you think that digital has stopped becoming a goal in itself and more us sort of subservient to the better, you know, the bigger goal of experience? Or do you think most brands still haven't figured that part out?
I think some brands have figured it out. It's just a new world. It's a parallel universe that showed up that didn't exist 20 years ago in the form it exists today. I think some brands still believe in connected commerce. So the way I behave on a call center is different from a retail store, and it's different from a website purchase. So I've seen great sophistication where you can buy on a website, return at store. You can walk into an event and they know who you are and what your prior preferences are. So we've got to that level of mastering the new topology, if you like, of this new domain. I think when you use digital in the physical world and the physical assets in a digital world, you have a new realm that I think is going to be the future. It's not started yet because AI is the current state. But give it another year or so, and I think we'll see a metaversian confluence. It's a terrible term to use, but I've seen products that are starting up where if you were sitting in a city 10,000 miles away and I had to pay you and I knew the location of your phone, I could simply airdrop $50 to pay you at your GPS location. And that's a new way of combining digital and physical. You're physically 10,000 miles away, but I've just not, you know, and you've not shared with me too many details. The other example that I think will happen, and it's a bit, I'm not trying to be someone who can foretell the future here, but imagine a disk that you plugged into your laptop and you said to the machine, I want to see a Michael Jackson show. And it played a hologram for you right from that disc. So to me, these things are possible where it's just the technology hasn't picked up, caught up. But I see a metaverse in immersion. I see the first signs with Apple's products and Facebook's glasses and, you know, the Oculus. It's happening, but it's going to be very big in, I think, a couple of years. But you never know.
There's just two types of worlds. This sort of augmented physical world, and then there's sort of the purely virtual world. And it, you know, just through the sense of space, it just kind of feels like the virtual world is a lot more interesting because there's a lot more surface area to play with and personalize, whereas essentially the augmented reality, while it's around you, it's also, there's only so much to overlay. And of course, you can personalize it to the nth degree, like a Minority Report or something like this. So,
yeah, I think, you know, I've seen some products of late where I think they're just so beautiful. They address only the first part of experience. You know, you asked me the question about experience, and I remember doing a town meeting in my company and reminding folks that experience is in four stages. Maybe there are actually 10 stages, but I, for simplicity, broke it down to four stages. You know, there's the experience of discovery, which is totally different from the experience of engagement. And then there's the purchase, and then there's consumption. So I used a mnemonic. It was attract, interact, transact, and react. Four distinct stages. And the way you build a brand that's already known, they are more interested in loyalty and advocacy. So that's the react piece. But a new brand wants an audience, and so they are focused on attraction. How do I get people to engage and take them through the path of purchase, which is, of course, transact, through the second piece, which is hyper-personalized interact. So when you break these experiences into four distinct stages, and then you draw a vector which has 15 to 16 surfaces, where it could be a store, it could be an email chat, it could be an advert out of home, it could be a human being. You know, you have all these channels, and connecting the experience between 16 channels and four stages of discovery, never an easy thing to do. And the one common piece in the middle was this thing called purpose. And so we believed a lot in human-centered, purpose-driven experiences. And that took the transition, in at least in our case, from CX, we used to use the term CX for everything, customer experience, to HX, which is human experience. Because humans are also suppliers, they're also partners, and they're also clients, and they're also employees. So, you know, you had to, thanks to COVID, focus on employees, you had to focus on your supply chain, which was distressed. And it was not so much about customers, because, you know, that was a different matter. Weekly. So it really is a field, experience is a field that, because it's also evolving, it's never going to be solved, but it'll stay evergreen. And as long as it stays evergreen, agencies will have a place, I think.
Yeah, and not to mention that there are already people out there convinced that the agent-driven buying process is going to be great, much greater than the humans too. So I think agencies advising companies about how to set up workflows for these sorts of things and how they interact and when they should interact seems still like a very fertile area of exploration.
I think it is. And, you know, especially if you think about behavior and purpose, and you have people from different, but great diversity in different countries, priorities are not the same. Sophistication is not the same. And everything is different, right? So preferences are different. And the world has no borders today. It's proven from our commerce partners. You can see an Australian company dominate the B2B space, and Canadian company dominate the B2C space, and a Brazilian company do well in mass spaces, and so on. You know, so yeah, it's going to be a new world out there. You know, for the agencies at least, I have hope.
Yeah, well, I mean the hope. I mean, it sounds like your hope. I mean, ironically, as tech forward as you are and bullish as you are on the future of AI as a tool, you're also very bullish on the creativity of humans and the role of humans to inspire, create, build, and give the world meaning, not just, as you said, be a robotaxi from one place to another.
Yeah, because, you know, the next destination comes from curiosity, and there's no map for it, right? So humans will always find new journeys and destinations, and I think that's beyond AI, at least now. I don't know what's going to come next, but I truly believe the next 10 years are going to be phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. As an agency owner, you've, I'm sure, met with thousands of brands in your career. And I'm sure at this point, you sort of have your own internal stack ranking mechanism for, like, this one's going to do well, this one's not going to do well. Just based on what you were saying a second ago, this sort of curiosity quotient, like, what do you have to push the boundaries? What in the brands that you think aren't being imaginative enough, like, what question do you think needs to be asked of them? Or what question that does a brand owner need to be asking themselves to make sure that they're pushing their own boundaries fast enough?
I mean, it's very difficult for me to, you know, advise brands on what to do, because they have the mechanics kick in, right? They're constrained by what they can do and think. But some of the CEOs I've met are thinking about how behavior is changing. When I was a kid, driving was not an option. It literally was not an option. I had to learn to get a license, and I had to drive. And I've lived in Singapore, I've lived in India, I've lived in London, and of course America. And every place is different, right? But today's kids, with the rise of a Lyft and an Uber and all these things,
right?
And if you live in a city, driving is optional,
right?
So you know, if you start to think about how behavior is changing at that fundamental level, I think brands will learn a lot, because just pumping out product doesn't help, right? Because behavior is so radically changing. Cooking was an essential prerequisite. When my mom said, you're going to leave home, you've got to learn how to cook.
Right, right.
And today, I don't know whether the younger generation thinks it's a priority. It's a life skill, but it's not a necessary life skill. Uh-huh. So I believe that whatever field brands are in, if it's food, if it's motion, if it's anything, right? A writing instrument like pens. Uh-huh. Think about it. I didn't type on a computer till 1990. You know, I used to write longhand, and I love my letters, and it's all gone completely in one generation.
Right.
So it's the ability for those brands to see that change and morph to meet that new requirement. And that's curiosity-led. The best CEOs I've met are the ones who are curious, always asking questions. They have no answers when you meet them, but they are asking questions. Yeah. And I love those people because they're curious.
Yeah. No, I mean, that curiosity, I think that is a good place probably for us to end up, because I think a lot of brands need to be curious, not about their customers and about the market and about the why people make the decisions that they do and about what are their goals and what will help them reach their goals or to make their life more meaningful and enriching, versus someone who's just like, oh, how can I build a better mousetrap for the sake of shaving a few pennies here and there? I don't think you can create the next generational company that way.
I totally agree with you. I think you were, without that, you created a beautiful term, and I'm going to stuck in my head, you know, CQ, which is curiosity quotient. It's a beautiful term used. But when I was with my agency, we had a framework which had three layers. It's like three concentric circles, you know. And I always would say the outer layer is behavioral experience. Sorry, brand experience. How do you want to look in the 16 channels that are out there? So how should your emails look? How should your website look? How should your mobile phone app look? And then underneath that was the behavioral experience layer, where people behaved on the surface that you presented in different ways. So when you're in a call center, you're different from in a store. And then you sucked out this data of this behavior from these 16 channels and sucked it into a book of record. And in that book of record, you created a longitudinal record of behavior for, say, the lead Keshu. You found out my name, my email, my phone number. But the next time I touch another surface, you kind of figured out, oh, this guy likes chess. So you've got another piece of information, and you make this record longer and longer and longer. And to me, as you build these, the longitude of a human being, you know, with, and it goes a full circle, you then start to look at the person's behavior on the latitude, sorry, longitude this way and latitude this way, but you know what I mean, because you don't behave on each latitude the same way. And so you build a 360 globe of behavior, and at the core, of course, will be AI trying to make sense of how people behave differently in different channels. But I think the second piece, which is this behavioral experience, that part is the most difficult to do, because people are not the same.
Yeah, people are also, people are unpredictable, people are logical, fearful, you know, all the things, right? So.
Yeah, and we are cognitive beings. So, if we've had a bad experience with one surface, then we may not repeat it on another surface, though it might be totally different, right?
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, this has been, I think, a fantastic conversation for me, just trying to tease out what's the essence of design, creativity, curiosity. What's the place of a brand as a service provider in the world? I do think, you know, you've kind of evolved from purpose to human-centered design, but I still do think that purpose needs to be the core of it, because we can't, at the end of the day, any service provider, it can't be all things to all people.
I think that's what defined us. Now, I'm not sure if we lived up to, you know, the promise, because, you know, it is such a relative term. And you start to sometimes wonder whether, because, you know, it becomes a fad very often, you know, like ESG and, you know, corporate sustainability and things like that. So purpose comes in different forms, and it's a fairly gray term. It's amorphous. So I've struggled with it a little bit, but it certainly made us feel good coming to work, that we were doing it because we were purpose-driven and human-centered.
Right.
But, you know, that was an experience.
Yeah, but I think us co-creating this curiosity quotient here, that also certainly makes you excited to come into work, because now you're trying to learn something new and asking fun questions like why not or what if, and not caring about results per se. And to me, that's where the fun part is, where you're taking some risk and you're not thinking about it as a risk, because you're just enjoying the journey.
You know, I did a seminar, not a webinar, for a group of young leaders, I think it was yesterday or day before yesterday. And they asked me questions around, you know, how creative should one be and how should a young leader be at work? And I had a simple formula for it, and that is unask the question. So when you go to work as a young creative person, someone will give you a brief And we have a tendency to respond to the breach. But if you just stopped and said, unasked that question, why are you asking me this question? You start to question the questioner, why would you want me to answer this question or respond to it? It's irrelevant. It's not going to have any consequence. Asking a question is one thing, but unasking a question makes you reflect on purpose. Why am I doing this? Just because someone asked me to do it, I'm doing it. So, it's interesting. I spend a lot of time, especially these days, on these somewhat philosophical thoughts.
Yeah, and I think this should be a good guide to the audience, especially people that are early in career trying to understand what's my place here? What am I doing all this? So I really appreciate your time today, Dilip. It's been a marvelous, interesting conversation, which is always my bar for where we go, and you've exceeded that in spades. So,
thank you for inviting me, and you're a legend in your own right. So I'm very honored to be here. Thank you.
No, thank you so much, Dilip. I appreciate it.